From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. He's the executive at Adult Swim who's partly responsible for the existence of the rap duo Run the Jewels.
Mike and Elle, I had worked with previously on multiple projects, and when Mike came to me and wanted to do a solo album, we were trying to decide who was going to do the music, and I said, have you heard of this guy LP? And he said, I've heard of him, but I don't really know the music. And so I basically got him to listen to the music. He's like, great, I love this guy. So I called Elle. Elle was working on a solo record, and I said, you got to fly down, and I want you to work with Mike on a couple songs for a solo record.
That's Jason DeMarco, Senior VP and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta's own Adult Swim. We talk with Jason later this hour about how to source and select the perfect music for broadcast. But we would love to know, what are your favorite TV soundtracks or theme songs? Give us a call. Let us know at 404-500-9457. You can sing it if you're brave. You can also post some tunes on our Facebook page or our Twitter feed. We're at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments or musical picks on the show. For the last several years, Issa Rae has been on a mission to prove there's not just one way to be a black woman in comedy. You may have seen her web series, The Misadventures of an Awkward Black Girl. It premiered in 2011.
Let me introduce myself. My name is Jay, and I'm awkward and black. Someone once told me those were the two worst things anyone could be.
Rae's latest project is the HBO series called Insecure.
Hey, Poppy. Where you going?
It's too aggressive.
I just want to be confident. Brave me. I want to be that person. Let's have fun tonight.
I'm Jared.
Issa.
Issa Rae has been nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series, Musical, or Comedy. She joined me in 2016 ahead of a screening in Atlanta, and I asked her why she decided to keep her real name for the show.
You know what? If I could go back, I wouldn't, because it got really confusing. Like doing post-production, getting notes and things like that. But I just wanted to show that this was kind of a show about me and my life, not necessarily a biography, but this character was true to my essence.
But how concerned are you that fans are going to see this as a biography and going to ask you about things that happen in the show as though they happened to you?
Very concerned, because they did the same for Awkward Black Girl, and that wasn't even my name. So I just don't put it past anyone.
How do you handle that then, if they did that when you were doing the web series as well?
I mean, I just tell them that it's not true, you know, but I wish you had asked me these questions when I first started pitching it, because I definitely didn't think ahead.
Okay. So I saw this one video that you'd posted in which you were giving advice to your younger self. I think it was called Hashtag Dear Me. And the main thing you wanted to tell your younger self was to not be concerned about whether you were black enough. Is that part of the theme of this new series as well, insecurity over what kind of black you are?
In a very subtle way. I think there's just there are preconceived notions of blackness that we want to override with this series, and I think with this character. And she, in the very opening episode, talks about how her best friend is loved by white people and black people alike, and she isn't. And I think that she may confuse that with perceptions of blackness that she doesn't fit, but she'll soon find that it's a bit more than that. But that's just something that I've always explored in my themes, in all of my work, just the different types of black people, and the fact that we're not a monolith, and that we have varied experiences that inform and shape us. And the character's journey to security or to confidence will lie in challenging that and asking those questions.
I mean, honestly, the opening few minutes of it have to be one of the funniest opening few minutes of any pilot ever. I mean, this is a group of, for those, I don't think I'm giving any spoilers. It's a classroom full of kids who are asking you really inappropriate questions. And one of them is like, why do you talk like a white girl?
Right.
How many of those questions have you actually gotten from a kid or otherwise?
I've got all those questions in real life.
But not from kids. I don't want to say all of them.
But all of those questions have been asked to me at some point in life, either when I was a kid or by kids at some point. Yes, I can honestly say that.
They asked you what was up with your hair.
Oh, my God. Come on. Yes.
Have you gotten better at fielding those kind of things, or do people just not ask you that stuff anymore?
You definitely get asked some things, you know, but I don't get asked why I talk like a white girl at all anymore. But I mean, I think that's just more of growing up and people realizing that, okay, speaking proper English is not equated with speaking white, you know, and some of the other questions have just been, you know, I use any question that's offensive, I will turn and flip back. Like, you use humor as a defense mechanism. So that's something that I've grown to do. I will jab back and clap back quickly.
I don't want to make it seem like this show is about being black, because it seems to just be about more, at least I've seen one episode. I saw the pilot, and that wouldn't seem to have been more about friendship and how to be a good friend. And so how do you balance those things? And I ask that because there's so few African-American or people of color anchoring sitcoms on either on mainstream TV or on cable at all. So to a certain extent, you're a representative. And I wonder how you balance that with just wanting to put together a good storyline about human beings.
One, we wanted to just tell a story about regular people that happen to be black. And that was first and foremost. Like, we didn't want to hit you over the head with the fact that, oh my God, we're black and all black issues, because that's not how black people talk. That's not how people of color talk. Like, we just wanted to create something real at the end of the day and portray something real. And so, you know, situations arise from being a person of color, and, you know, we wanted to talk about those and feature those incidents, those experiences, and again, didn't want to be didactic and be like, here's a lesson to learn from them. Just be like, okay, this is just a part of what we deal with in our day-to-day lives in a very slice-of-life show, and made sure that was the core of our storytelling. And it helps when you have a writer's room that's diverse. You have, you know, people with varied experiences who are also contributing things from their own personal lives, so it doesn't feel like we're just making stuff up at the end of the day to teach a lesson.
So one of your writing partners is, of course, Larry Wilmore, and his program, The Nightly Show on Comedy Central, was just canceled last week. Let's hear a little bit of it.
But I'm Larry Wilmore, your next host for the next, 29 minutes and 31 seconds. Now, let me just say, it's never easy when your television show gets canceled. But I have to tell you, for me, there has been a silver lining, you guys. All the free booze.
So, what worked against Larry, do you think? And I ask that because there seems to be a difficulty, in the United States at least, for an African American to find success hosting a talk show. And except for Oprah, she's the one outlier to a certain extent.
That's so
bad. but we have no problem with African Americans with Beyonce. I mean, there are some arenas in sports or in music where their sky is the limit, and in some areas where it isn't. Why?
We always joke about the fact that there's like one slot for us. Like, we're always fighting on one slot. And if you hire like one black person, now you can't have another black person on, you know, like that's it. And, you know, I think that the Comedy Central prides itself on The Daily Show. And I do think that in hiring, you know, another black person to fill the spot. Trevor Noah, simple Americans and simple viewers and possibly simple executives were like, well, people aren't watching both. People don't want to watch both. So instead of pairing them together and having them work with one another to show how different they are and how different their voices are, they sort of played into the fact that it had to be one or the other, which really sucks. And it's their loss at the end of the day, but Larry will be just fine.
Okay, so last year we spoke with another comedian, George Wallace. He was born and raised here in Atlanta, and he's been doing stand-up for 4 decades or so. I asked him a question about how comedy has changed over the past 40 years, and here was his answer.
It's still basically the same. We just discuss it differently. People express themselves differently. When I was a kid starting comedy, the young kids, we didn't use swear words, curse words. Now the young kids in rapping, they express themselves differently. So, and it's much harder to be clean and funny than it is to be every other word. I have nothing against blue comedians, because funny is funny. Let's make that perfectly clear.
I wonder how easy the transition is between doing a web series where you basically have a lot of freedom, and then you're at HBO where you also have a lot of freedom. Would you have been able to reproduce this on, say, NBC?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, maybe that's one of the big advantages of doing a show on cable and on HBO specifically, which is you know, very writer friendly and very voice friendly. I think that, yeah, I've always maintained that if I ever took a show to television, I wanted to be on HBO specifically for those very reasons. I don't think that I would have been able to tell the same story on any network.
Do you have censors? Do you have to get your plot lines and your writing through a board or somebody who's editing?
We deal with basically two development executives who are very, very smart. And as a team, you know, Prentice, our showrunner, we just navigate their notes, and they really help to make it better. But it's very small, which helps. And there's not, you're not going through a studio and for notes and then a network for notes and then, you know, dealing with advertisers and things like that. It really is streamlined with just two people, which is so refreshing.
So do you have like a list in your head of stereotypes you kind of want to address? I mean, do you think, okay, here's one thing people assume about Black people or Black women, and I want to make sure I get to this on my show. Do you have that sort of list somewhere in your subconscious?
There are some experiences that I definitely want to touch on, but for the most part, I want to make sure that the character, that anything that happens stays true to the characters that we've presented thus far. But there are definitely stories that I want to tell and things that I want to discuss and have people discuss. Yeah, there's definitely a list in the back of my mind.
Okay, how about these two? And these come from comedian Dulcie Sloan, who's from Atlanta, just moved to L.A. She brought up two stereotypes she has had enough of.
The only time I've given this trope of the angry Black woman or the sassy Black woman or whatever is when white people say that. Black people, I'm just a Black person who talks. Like, I don't have to prove my Blackness to anybody because I'm Black all day. And if anyone questions my Blackness, they're usually white or a Black person I don't know. So, you know, I don't try to make excuses for my comedy. I don't try to explain it to anybody. If you get it, you get it. You don't, you don't.
Where are you on that spectrum of caring what people, what comments, either whites or Blacks say?
I'm exactly with her. She couldn't have put it better. And that is something that we addressed in a show, actually a few episodes in. So you'll definitely see that addressed and acknowledged. But I 100% agree with her. I don't care at this point. And that's something that I'm so proud of with this show is that we're not like, they're inside jokes. There's a vernacular that we use. There's so many things that we don't feel the need to explain because we don't have to, you know, in the same way we make no apologies. It's very much like a bias for us, but everybody's welcome to watch type of show.
So to me, it feels surprising that I'm talking to you about this when you studied African-American studies at Stanford, but it may not be. Was this sort of a goal for you all along?
What? I would like to tell my dad that. It was very disappointed. That, like, hey, Dad, this was all the plan, you know? But no, I mean, you hope that, like, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to direct and produce, but I didn't think it would come to this. You know, you hope, but I never imagined.
That's writer and actress Issa Rae. She's the creator and star of the HBO series Insecure. Rae is up for a Golden Globe. The Golden Globes are this Sunday at 8 p.m. Coming up, the man behind the music at Atlanta's own Adult Swim. First, though, what does it take to be a successful Black business owner in the South? This is On Second Thought. This is your
station, baby. Look inside these walls and you see him having withdrawals of a prisoner on his way. Trapped inside your desire to fire bullets that stray. Track a tire, just tell you I'm tired and ran away. I should ask a choir, what do you require to sing a song that acquire me to have faith? That's the record spin, I should pray for the record.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. While Georgia may be comparatively better for African-American business owners, that doesn't mean it's easy here. A recent Prosperity Now study finds Black businesses face huge hurdles in the South. White-owned businesses average over $500,000 in revenue a year. Black businesses average just a tenth of that. I talked about this with Dennis Kimbrough, professor of business at Clark Atlanta University.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what you think of this particular study and whether or not you find it credible that Black-owned businesses would be making just a tenth of the profit of a comparable white-owned business.
Well, number one, I would like to applaud the authors for bringing this to light. But you know what? They're really not saying anything new. I was just listening to the survey, the comments before, and when you look at the South, it's really bifurcated. There are some areas of the South that are really struggling for entrepreneurs, and there's some that are really flourishing. Atlanta happens to be one that's flourishing, and it's flourishing for a reason. There are, you know, common attributes when you look at success and successful Black businesses. Number one, do they have access to capital? Number two, do they have the contacts? And number three, what about the contracts? The best customer in the world is a repeat customer, and that will certainly put any entrepreneur, whether Black, white, green, whatever, on the fast track.
Let's go with that first one, access to capital, because let's play this comment from Ron Busby. He's the president of Black Chambers. He's speaking here with Roland Martin on News One Now, and he's pointing to exactly that as possibly a reason why Black-owned businesses struggle more.
If you ask any small business owner what their number one concern is, they will say access to credit. But when you ask Black businesses, their top three concerns is access to credit. And it has very little to do with our acumen. It has very little to do with our businesses. It really is a conversation about banks not wanting to take the risk to be able to provide those loans to business owners in our communities.
How much of a barrier is access to credit or liability, trying to convince a bank for Black-owned businesses?
Well, I tell my students at Clark Atlanta University, the first step to entrepreneurship is savings. The reason why, if you can't save 10% of everything that you earn, the seeds of greatness aren't in you, because that's when opportunity really occurs. And if you don't have the savings, I mean, you are thrown on the cusp of A, either looking at the SBA for a loan or going to
the
commercial,
Small Business Association.
Going to commercial credit. Financial literacy is the key. And I can sit here and tell you all the indices and indicators or the lack thereof of financial literacy in the Black community. 27% of African Americans have no savings plan. More than 30% spend more on a weekly basis than what they bring in. And more than 40% of African Americans are non-banked or unbanked. Well, that's going to spill over into you pursuing an opportunity. If you don't have the funds to go ahead and capitalize that, regardless if it's a high hurdle, low hurdle, or whatever, you won't be able to participate in that market. So, you know, things happen for a reason. I shared in another conversation that I had in 1934, Federal Housing Authority came up with that idea of redlining, where they took a red pen and they drew it around certain areas within metro areas. Well, redlining has legs, and it occurred in 1934, and here we are in 2017. You are seeing the end result of years of discrimination in terms of economic development.
I just want to make sure our listeners are all staying with us. Redlining is a process in which someone is refused either a bank loan or insurance, mm-hmm. even, because they live in a particular area that's either deemed to be majority minority or it's deemed to be poor. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, they're charged. Even if you do get a loan, if you're redlined, you charge more.
Without a doubt, in terms of suppressing
economic development. And your insurance premiums will be higher.
Exactly. So, you know, that certainly has an effect. But that doesn't mean that, you know, opportunity is insurmountable. What's going on here in Atlanta in terms of contacts, several years ago, completed a 7-year study on Black millionaires. Atlanta is either number 3 or 4 in terms of Black millionaires. So new entrepreneurs or potential entrepreneurs, they can see what's possible. And they have the contacts where they can reach out and seek mentorship and seek advisors, which is another key component. A lot of times, money is not just the answer. You need somebody to advise you and somebody to mentor you. Okay, what's the next step in the process? What do I do now? And then last but not least, contracts. You know, my mind goes back to the early 1980s when Maynard Jackson was mayor of Atlanta and he rebuilt, you know, Atlanta Airport, and he said we were going to use minority representation. Well, the bottom line, he created 14 Black millionaires in the process of rebuilding that airport.
So let's hear one more comment. This is Connie Evans. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dennis Kimbrough. He's a professor of business at Clark Atlanta University, and we're talking about a new study that shows black businesses actually bring in about a tenth of the revenue that a similar white business does. So this is Connie Evans that we're hearing here. She's with the Association for Enterprise Opportunity, and she points out another problem with minority-owned business.
It's not only the wealth gap, the starting wealth gap, the starting the capital gap, but we also recognize a third important gap, which is the trust gap. But we found that the interplay of those three gaps is really what's keeping businesses from being able to reach their potential.
What is the trust gap?
The trust gap is if you can't find, you know, mentors, or if you can't find advisors that look like you, talk like you, think like you, whatever, then you're forced to go to different areas. Imagine I'm reading this study now where you have low-income black entrepreneurs seeking out somebody, you know, that's in their particular industry that they're in. They don't know anything about this individual. And the individual, if I walked into your office right now and I said, you know, I'm going to be your competitor in this line, can you share with me the pitfalls and how you overcame them? The trust gap is going to be pretty low. So you're going to need what we call executive presence. And what is executive presence? You're going to need somebody to skill you. You're going to need the, you know, the soft skills. You're going to need the norms and mores of how to compete effectively in a capitalistic economy. Long before anybody can trust you.
Okay, so if we're talking about a capital gap, and that's one of the reasons I assume why it's generational, because I can think of three friends right now who were able to start their business because their parents gave them money, a loan.
Exactly.
Zero interest loan in that particular case. So there's the capital gap.
And usually that occurs 25 to 30% for white entrepreneurs.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So, and that's not happening very often. Not generational wealth.
Only 42% of African Americans even own their own home.
Okay, so
there's
no
equity there. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the access to capital. Mm-hmm. In terms of either loans and insurance. Mm-hmm. And then what you're calling is the trust gap. So what's our most powerful lever that we can throw to fix some of this?
You know, I hate to be simplistic in it, but what I have found is that nothing can stop the passionate, committed mind. What is the definition of entrepreneurship? And we need to know this before we go in. Entrepreneurship is the pursuit of an opportunity without any regard to the resources at hand. So what you are saying is that I don't have the money, I don't have the capital, I don't have the contacts, but this opportunity I'm going to pursue. There is something to be said about the passionate, committed mind. And I tell my students a lot of times, the passionate, committed mind can't be defeated. If it could be defeated, there would be no Bob Johnson of BET. There would be no Oprah Winfrey. So that's number one. Number two, you can't GET to your ASK. And the more that I tell my students, if you don't study, if you don't grow, if you don't develop, if you don't go to the seminars, if you don't go to the conferences, if you don't ask the key questions, somebody out in the universe will. And the day that you meet that other individual, you're going to lose. That's a part of the process. And then last but not least, people tell to me, Dr. Kimbrough, entrepreneurship is like a roller coaster. It's highs and lows and ups and downs and, you know, days in which I don't eat. And this, when does a roller coaster ride end? And I said, when you get off it. Entrepreneurship is gut-wrenching. Entrepreneurship is pain-inducing. Entrepreneurship is a marathon, not a sprint. It's built on inconvenience. But the good news is it's better than failing. If this is your chosen line of work, sooner or later, if you got the sticktivity, you're going to meet the contacts, the money will be there, and you'll be able to make a difference.
The sticktivity? That's a technical term?
Persistence.
We only have about a minute left, but how much of this is also on black consumers and whether they choose to support black businesses or not?
That has a lot to do with it. You know, there are about 177 countries that belong to the United Nations. In terms of wealth, black America's number 16. You know, our buying power is estimated to be $1.3 trillion of the $17 trillion U.S. market. But when you look at where we spend our money, less than a nickel of every dollar is spent in the black community. No other ethnic group does that. I mean, if you look at the Asian community, the average dollar stays in the Asian community for 24 days. If you look at the Jewish community, the average dollar stays in the Jewish community 19 days. The average dollar only stays in the Black community 6 hours. So no other group does that. Our most prolific scholar, Black America's most prolific scholar, W.B. Du Bois, wrote a book in 1897 called The Negro in Business. And he had two profound, you know, sentences in that book. Number one, okay, if the man or woman who won't control their finances won't control anything else. And number two, nothing positive will ever occur in a community that fails to circulate its dollars.
That's Dennis Kimbrough. He's a professor of business at Clark Atlanta University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
In the 1990s, blues guitarist Eric Gales was hailed as a child prodigy. With his left-handed playing technique, many compared the Memphis, Tennessee musician to Jimi Hendrix. Gales' latest record is called Middle of the Road, and it was released last year. He'll be in Atlanta tomorrow night. Producer Trevor Young caught up with him last week.
Hey, everybody. My name is Eric Gales. I'm lead guitarist and vocalist for the Eric Gales Band, and we're very, very, very excited to be visiting Atlanta, and it's going to be amazing.
Hey, everybody, I'm finally doing like I should, y'all. I got tired of doing bad.
It's a piece of me and a piece of my story in every single song that I've recorded. So I would have to say it's the whole body of material that at some point gives some sort of direction to something that I've been through. And, you know, at some point, any part of any song, it gives an example for me through some sort of pain. To me, the pain creates the most emotional stuff for some reason. There's definitely been some struggles that I've been through that has given me a whole lot to play about.
I know you get your doubts. I know what all y'all thinking of. Put me to a test, y'all, and I surely rise above. Some have heard me say,
I think Middle of the Road was my exact intention of giving blues and rock, giving it a 2017, 2018 approach. And, you know, I just tried to, you know, keep it as raw, but yet new. You know, I like all different types and styles of stuff. So I try to incorporate a lot of that in this Middle of the Road record, but still hold true to the genuine, you know, core of, you know, blues-based, you know, foundation that I came from. And I think throughout the course of this whole record, Middle of the Road, that we're touring heavily off of now is a fine example of that. There is a sort of a grimier, you know, grit down, raw sort of perspective from a lot of things that come from the South when you look at it as a whole that I think that definitely has, you know, if not from my generation, definitely from my brothers, you know, and I was around older people. So a lot of people tell me that I have an old soul. So it's a lot of stuff from back in the day that, you know, I have related to, that I think that just carried on into my style, you know, and the underlying bed of it is something that definitely contains ingredients of some old down south sort of type recipe that you know, I think with a combination of the two put together, I think it's a pretty unstoppable combination.
I'll never walk away, pretty girl. I'm in your lane, you can drive, girl. 'Cause my keys are in the palm of your hand. Oh, yeah. 'Cause I love the way you carry yourself.
After every show, I'm literally drained from as much power and intensity that I put into every single note that I can. And, you know, it's just a combination of, you know, things that I've been through and, you know, a lot of struggles that I think that I wouldn't have been through if it weren't for me that taking myself through them. But with that, you know, I'm just happy to have the opportunity to be here again and come out on the other side and in my opinion, coming stronger than ever.
That's blues guitarist Eric Gales. He'll perform at Terminal West tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Just ahead, one guy programs all the music you hear on Adult Swim, and he tells us what goes into those musical choices. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Independent musicians have a real friend in Atlanta, Adult Swim. The popular late-night network buys music from a large number of largely unknown artists. Adult Swim even had its own record label called William Street Records, now called Adult Swim Singles, and it licenses new tracks from a whole slew of indie producers. All the music you hear on Adult Swim, from bumpers to promos to show soundtracks, are sourced by one guy. Jason DeMarco is Adult Swim's Senior Vice President and Creative Director of On Air. I talked to him in the fall.
Hello.
So first, the first thing that comes to mind, obviously, is that you're very busy.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough to have more than one job within my job, but I am very pleasantly busy. Yes. All
like,
the time.
Give me an estimate. How many new bands do you listen to on like a weekly basis?
Well, so I have so much music on my hard drive that I can't do streaming services because just waiting for it to sync with Spotify, my computer crashes.
Wow.
So I'm even.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So I'm one of the only people that probably still buys music. So I probably buy 5 to 7 records a week, every week, pretty much. And that's on an average week.
So, you know, sometimes these corporate collaborations with artists can go really bad.
Yeah. Often.
Yes. I would say more often than not.
Yeah.
So was that in your minds when you first started this?
I mean,
how to avoid it, I mean?
Yeah. I mean, what was in my mind was part of my job is doing partnerships with advertisers. So actually all these music projects were born out of coming up with ideas to involve advertisers to do things that beyond just sponsoring a commercial for a show. And part of what we deal with advertisers is translating the weirdness of Adult Swim through the broadness of your average advertiser message. So through that, I think I learned a lot about how to keep creative sort of firewalled in a way. And I knew that if we were going to do something with musicians, we kind of had to take the same approach.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, but it almost feels as though if it's just coming from an advertising perspective, it would make it harder to create a firewall.
It is. but I had to get the money from somewhere, basically. Before, like, these started by doing extra projects the advertisers would sponsor, and I would use the advertiser money to pay for it. And then once they did well enough and Adult Swim fans kept coming to us and saying, we want more of this, we want more of this. Now we just pay for it out of our own budget for the most part. But it had to prove itself. And I used advertiser money to do that.
So how do you then protect artists from the kind of exploitation that occurs in many of these other corporate collaborations?
We basically keep everything very, very simple. We approach the artist because I already know who they are and I already know what they do, and I am only asking them for a new song that we won't own. We're simply licensing for some period of time. They can own, they own it. They will release it on their own however they want. We're only releasing it for a particular window where it's exclusive to us. So going to an artist, it's literally like a bag of money is falling out of the sky for to give you to literally do what you're already doing.
Right, to pay you to create something.
To create something you will own, and we are simply licensing. And non-exclusively. So they could even license it to someone else after our little exclusivity period. It's theirs to do with what they will. So it's just such an easy deal for artists. And then when we talk to advertisers, we say, look, the artist is not going to write a song about your product. We're simply approaching them to get a song, and you can help us present it to the public. Because even advertisers are smart enough to know that something good that's free given to, like, anyone on the street is going to leave them with a better impression than something watered down and horrible, or at least a lot of them are smarter.
Not all of them.
No, not all of them.
Not going to name names.
The ones that want to work with us, maybe, is how I was.
So that must be the philosophy, or I don't want to make assumptions, but the philosophy behind where you began with your record label selling music,
yeah,
and now you give it away. Mm-hmm. So is this process what you're talking about here? Why
sort
that
of.
Happened?
We started the record label because we had done some music projects that were very successful with other labels, and we thought, well, why don't we just try it on our own? Unfortunately, this was around 2007 when the music industry was dying.
Tanked.
So we quickly realized, oh, we can't do this. We're not going to make any money at this. So then we had to step back and say, is it worth doing because people like it? Like, is it enough of a thing people associate with Adult Swim that we should keep doing it? And it turned out the answer was yes. So now we just do it as marketing because we get enough response from it that we know that part of the reason, one of many reasons why the average Adult Swim viewer watches Adult Swim, is to discover new things like music.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jason DeMarco, VP and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta's own Adult Swim. And let's actually listen to a little music.
Okay.
This is 20 past four. It's from Noble Oak. So what do you go to the artists with? I mean, do you describe a kind of atmosphere or mood you want, or what do you ask them for?
I really keep it very open, I think. And for me, that's been the best approach, is to go in with no expectations, because some artists will come to me and say, I want to do something really different with you guys than I would normally do. You know, just last week we released a 3-hour song from someone who obviously they couldn't fit a 3-hour song on their own record. So they thought, well, I'll do this. And so there's that. And then the other thing is, I never like telling an artist what to do. And I'm always going to them with my approach is always, I already know who you are. I know your music and I like it. That's why we're coming to you in the first place. So simply do what you do, whatever that is.
You also release whole albums, and
yes.
and here is one of them. This is a song from the show Metalocalypse.
Club.
Yes, what you said. This is actually the song Thunder Horse by the fictional band Deathlock. I mean, that sounds exactly like something a band named Deathlock would make.
Deathlock was the band Death inside Clock. The show Metalocalypse, which aired for, I think, 4 seasons. Yeah, and we made 4 soundtracks, did a couple tours, and those actually sold pretty well.
But so you actually had to go to a band and convince them to be a fictional band named Deathclaw.
In the case of that show, it's different. It's basically that one of the show creators, Brendan Small, was a metalhead, and he wrote all the music for the show. And the longer he worked on the show, the more we realized this could be its own thing. So then we did a tour where they had custom animation, and the band themselves were blacked out, and you couldn't see them. And it just was sort of like the animated band was playing all the music. And then the longer they did it.
Kind of like the Gorillaz.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, pretty much. And then the longer they did it, fans realized who was really making the music. And so then it started being a little more normal human interaction type stuff. But that was just, you know, when show creators have a particular musical point of view, and most of them do, we sort of, the same way we do with our other marketing stuff, we just let them sort of take it in whatever direction they want to. And obviously metal is one of the, you know, the genres that our fans really enjoy.
So let me play a song that probably a lot of people will recognize. This is the theme song from the Venture Brothers. It's got that dissonance in it that really fits.
Old school 60s style, too. I like it.
Yeah. So then how is the process different when you're just going to a band and saying, okay, we just need you to create something, as opposed to theme music? It seemed to me theme music needs a little bit more close collaboration.
Yeah. Theme music will very, very much be a collaboration between whoever the person making the music is and the show creator or the network, depending on who's talking to who. And there's always an approach where we're looking for this particular thing. Do you think you could deliver this style? So those guys knew they wanted a 1960s kind of classic style big band thing, and they went to J.G. Thirlwell, who also records as Fetus, who's a legend, and asked him, we know this isn't something you normally would do. Would you be into this? And sort of he just kept working back and forth with them until they got it to a good place. But it's way more, you know, there's a goal, because the theme show song has to set the tone for what you're about to watch in a way that the things that, like Adult Swim Singles, doesn't have to, because that's just a free song coming out of nowhere. A theme show song has to tell you something about the show.
And that's not short term either. That lives with the show.
Right. And that's the other thing. Even negotiating that takes way longer, because, you know, when you're giving away a song, you're just licensing it for a period of time. But when you're making a theme song, the network has to somewhat own it, and it has to be able to be used for till the end of time in, you know, all media. So it gets complicated depending on who you're, you know, if you're talking to an established artist like J.G. Thirlwell, a fiercely independent established artist, you have to make sure that you're coming to him with the right type of negotiation, or he'll just go, well, I don't want to do that, you know.
Is there a sound to Adult Swim?
So, you know, slowly that one has developed, I think. So I would say most of the music we use falls into three categories: electronic music, hip hop, or metal, because those are kind of the genres that through the years we've seen that fans really connect with. And, you know, to be blunt, that's what I listen to mostly. And I'm the person picking all the music. So we do have shows like Squidbillies that delve into country. We have done songs with folk artists, with country artists, with all genres. But for the most part, the vast majority of the music you're going to hear when you turn on Adult Swim is going to be electronic music, hip-hop, or metal of some kind, because those are the three genres that I still think are among the most exciting genres of music that are still changing and coming up with new forms for themselves and on the cutting edge of what can be. And that's kind of what I think, you know, Adult Swim's music should represent that, because I think as a network, we're trying to represent that.
So not much chance for klezmer.
No. Yeah. You're not going to hear much klezmer, probably. I mean, you might, but probably not. I bet we have.
There's a polka/punk band in Dearborn that, you know.
I know. And I guarantee if you went back through all of our bumps, there was some klezmer or polka used in a bump, but I guarantee it was probably in an ironic way.
So when you are listening to music, even if you like something, are there times when you really like a band, but you know that's not going to work for Adult Swim? And if so, what are you hearing?
Yeah, there are times. I mean, there are times when, you know, most of the music that we're going to be using is either going to go in a show, or it's going to go on in a bump or some sort of packaging element on television, or go in a commercial. And so if it's too slow or too sad, that's going to be rough, because we are a comedy channel and we're not sort of known for our slow dramas. So, you know, when you're watching television, the average viewer, you have to keep in mind that you're going into their home and they might be changing the channel and not knowing what they're about to see. So you have to think about how you're curating that experience. And something really, really slow and dirgy will probably kill the momentum. So that's the kind of thing where I may listen to, you know, a 2-hour ambient noise song, but that doesn't mean I'm going to use it in a promo for the Squidbillies, because it just
would be weird.
It wouldn't make sense. Not weird in a good way, just weird. So those are the reasons why I wouldn't use certain songs, because they just don't feel right for, hey, I'm watching a comedy network, you know.
Do you think that that Adult Swim sort of reflects the city in which it's made?
I would say so. I mean, we did a whole album of Atlanta rap artists being remixed by independent electronic musicians called ATL Remix. We did that like in 2008, way back. We've worked with Mastodon, Atlanta's number one metal band, for a number of years. We've done a bunch of music videos with them. We've featured a number of Atlanta bands pretty much every year on singles, and then we've done albums, and of course I've personally been involved a lot with Killer Mike of Run the Jewels.
No, wait, now there's a story out there that you actually introduced Killer Mike to LP.
Yeah.
That's a true story?
That is a true story.
Like, you're kind of responsible for Run the Jewels.
Yes, yes. I mean, luckily, Mike...
Did you get that engraved, like, on a plaque?
It'll be... I always say it's going to be what's on my gravestone. It's going to be, like, whatever I've done in my life, that's what people are going to care about, which is fine. That's a good thing to be remembered for as any. But, yeah, Mike and Elle, I had worked with previously on multiple projects, and when Mike came to me and wanted to do a solo album, we were trying to decide who was going to do the music, and I said, have you heard of this guy LP? And he said, I've heard of him, but I don't really know the music. And so I basically got him to listen to the music. He's like, great, I love this guy. So I called Elle. Elle was working on a solo record, and I said, you got to fly down, and I want you to work with Mike on a couple songs for a solo record. And he didn't want to do it because he's a curmudgeon. And I browbeat him into it, and he flew down here, and it was love at first sight. I mean, they spent a day in the studio, recorded three songs, and they walked out. Instantly, there was just an instant connection. So then we decided to make the whole rest of the record with Elle, and then they went on tour together, and kind of that really set it in stone. But yeah, they're very gracious in that they tell people all the time that I introduced
them.
They
do, yeah. But you never know if that's just being polite,
sure,
or if it's true.
But they're good friends. They both were at my wedding. You know, I mean, we hang out together on vacation, and like, we're just buddies. And it's really great to see two people that I know have been working so hard for so long do so well together when they're ready for it. You know, they're ready at this point in their career for that success. They know they've seen highs and lows. They know what to do with it. They know how to appreciate it, and they know how to make it last in a way that if this hit when they were 20, I don't know that they would have been able to hold on like they're doing now.
That's such a perfect transition to my next question, is what the advice you might have for doing business as a young artist, because I bet you see young artists making mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
Just in the profession.
Yes.
And there's probably common mistakes, right?
Very much so, yeah.
What are they?
I would say don't have your best friend be your manager. That's a very good first one, or your wife.
You see that a lot.
I see that a lot, yeah, especially in rap music. I would say read your contracts, read them well, and don't sign any contract that goes beyond two albums. And I would say show up on time, and when you say you're going to do something, do it. Because you'd be surprised how much that happens, where someone says, oh, I'm going to do this, and then they don't. And then you have to chase them down so that you can pay them. And it's very simple. It's like, just make it easy for someone to work with you so that if they have a good experience, they'll want to do it again. It's very, very simple, but it's a lot harder for people to seemingly get there than you would think.
That's Jason DeMarco, Senior Vice President and Creative Director of On Air at Atlanta-based Adult Swim. They're in the middle of their 52-week-long singles program. They release free music every week during this series, so go to adultswim.com to check out all the single drops every week. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. What is your favorite TV or movie soundtrack? And what kind of music kind of engages you while you're watching something? You know how to reach us. Call us at 404-500-9457 or post to Facebook and Twitter. We're at OST Talk. I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.